Welcome to the Mindful Medicina Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jeanette Daniels. I'm a naturopathic medical doctor on a mission to inspire a renewed confidence in the intelligence of the human body. And joining the conversation today is my friend and colleague, Janelle Hartman, lymphatic and colon hydrotherapist, esteemed yoga teacher of teachers, and the co-producer of this show. Louisa was raised to view God as nothing more than a human concept and spiritualism as a form of superstition. Then, in 1982, at a Manhattan nightclub, she suffered a cardiac arrest brought on by lidocaine poisoning. She shot out of her body and experienced an otherworldly journey to her God source, the sun. Upon returning to her body, she dismissed her experience as a hypoxic hallucination. She'd never heard of a near-death experience. And even if she had, she'd have considered the idea of crossing over to be ludicrous. But weird things began happening to her. Inexplicable events that wouldn't stop. She tried to shut her mind against seeing a ghost, knowing the future, and reading people's sometimes embarrassing thoughts until she came to understand that leaving her body had damaged whatever filter blocked out spirit energies. As a spirit voice continued to coach her in how to live wisely, Louisa accepted two facts. One, the spirit realm is real. And two, visiting it had gifted her with new perceptions. As a full-fledged woo-woo, Louisa found community among fellow near-death experiencers and began willing to share her story. Her mission is to overcome the egoic challenges that all humans face. With humor and humility, we're here to turn fear, anger, selfish greed, and gloating pride into love and compassion for all life. With love being our purpose here on Earth. She has two books, one titled Die Hard Atheist, From NDE Denier to Full-On Woo-Woo, Against My Will, and another book called A Spiritual Evolution, How 14 After Effects of a Near-Death Experience Help Cure My Addictions and Change My Life. She can be found on her website, aspiritualevolution.net. You can also find her on all social media platforms. We hope that you find this episode as inspiring as we did. Welcome, Louisa. It is so great to have you today. We have been really excited about this. So thank you so much for coming.
Yeah, thanks for being here. I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. We wanted to talk about medicine from the other side. So,
okay.
We thought this would be perfect. Could you give us a little background into your childhood before we dive into your NDE?
Yeah, so I was raised by two kind of injured children who didn't, they were adults, but they didn't really know how to be authentic or how to love. And alcohol played a big role in our daily life. It was kind of like Bewitched when Darren gets home, you know, pour me a double, you know, that's how they kind of went about things. So I don't think my parents really knew how to engage with a child. So I grew up very lonely, and we had no family on this side of the country, and we didn't have any church group. We were just very isolated, and I just grew up with all these feelings I didn't know what to do with, and just kind of feeling like I was a freak for having them. Mm-hmm. So very uncomfortable in school. I would just try to act like an actress in all of my interactions with other kids. And I was just very uncomfortable until I found alcohol.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when you started drinking?
My first drinks were when I was 3.
Wow. Oh, my.
So my dad would get his drinks, and he would start, come and sit and read storybooks with me while my mom was finishing dinner. It was very Leave It to Beaver-ish. And then my mom might call him into the kitchen to get help with something, and I would just down his drink. And when he came back, he was proud of me. I could tell. He'd be like, where'd you put that? Do you have a hollow leg? And he'd like tickle me a whole lot. And like, so getting tipsy was cute. And then we had our own beers when we were like 5. They'd give us a little juice glass of beer. And then I could always just hang out with my dad, take a few swigs off his beer. Mm. And so, but the odd thing was I really didn't discover getting wasted until I was a junior in high school. And my parents were left to go do something after dinner. And my younger sister had a date. And everybody had something to do except me. But they had tried this gallon of cheap Gala wine that they didn't like. And they said, Louisa, pour that out. So I poured it out, but down my throat. And I got so wasted. And I put Pink Floyd on the headphones. And I was just like dancing with the Beatles when I was playing them. I thought about everybody at school, and I just thought, I don't care about them. I don't care. And then I passed out on the love seat, and my parents came home and didn't see me there. So I got up, and my sister also came home from her date and didn't realize I wasn't in my bed. We shared a room. But I woke up at about 5 in the morning, sick as a dog. And this is very classic for alcoholics, trying not to barf. Went up to bed and thought, I can't wait to do that again.
Oh, my God. Yeah, the nausea didn't deter you.
Nothing is, compared to the freedom that alcohol gave me, any price was worth it.
Mm-hmm. So freedom was something that you felt you got from that.
Mm-hmm. And I was okay. I was good enough. And it's really the state that, if I meditate a lot now, you know, at age 63, and I come out of a really good meditation and I understand, like, God's got it, the universe has it, I'm just a passenger here, I would get that like that. Mm-hmm. And in a 16-year-old mind, you know? Mm-hmm. But it was, you know, from impairing my brain rather than working
and
with
a counterfeit version.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when you were young, did you ever experience any, I guess, sightings or sea spirits? You know how they talk about children being sort of having a thinner veil until they're somewhere around 7 years
old? Yeah, there's only one that I remember, which is I was going on my swing set and watching the reflections of the clouds in the puddles, because Seattle rains a lot, right? And I could kind of see them moving, and I just thought how beautiful they were. And all of a sudden, I felt this just great love for the birds, the clouds, everything to do with nature. And I went up and I lay down on, we had this hill in our backyard, and I lay at the top of the hill and looked at the sky. And I just understood that there was something that loved me. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have any name for it. I was 5. I certainly wouldn't have called it God. I just felt like there was something that adored me. Mm. And then that was lost when I got older.
Yeah. I mean, you were a self-proclaimed atheist.
Yes.
And, you know, so we can get a little bit into your NDE.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's a pretty big deal for someone who doesn't have any faith outside of the 3D plane, which mm-hmm. is where you played and where you wanted to feel free was here on the 3D plane. Mm-hmm. So if you want, you can go a little bit into your story now mm-hmm. and really give us as much detail as you can as to...
Do you want the whole experience?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
All right. All right. So, my father had really kind of made it clear to me that only foolish people believed in any kind of God, any kind of spirit, anything beyond science, which, or I guess we'd call it Newtonian science. But I had gotten much better at faking my persona so that I felt like I was able to come off as pretty cool. I had graduated from Vassar and kind of didn't have any more hoops to jump through. So I moved to New York, and New York was sort of a new challenge I set myself to go to the coolest clubs. And, you know, in those days, the bouncers would say, you're not cool enough, you can't go in, right? So it was almost like I just wanted some kind of way to validate myself. So if I could get into cool clubs and so on, I felt the self-esteem boost from that. So I was kind of, I don't know how to say this quickly, but between boyfriends is what I'll say. And a friend who was a coke dealer, I asked him to come to New York from New Jersey. And I said, let's go out dancing somewhere. So I knew he was a coke dealer. He brought coke. We did some coke before we left. We did coke in the taxi. You just do cocaine right there in the taxi. Like, you don't care, you know? And then we got to the cool nightclub, which was the Peppermint Lounge. And it was very high on my scale of coolness. And the new wave was down in the basement. And we were dancing. And I felt like I was almost there. Almost cool enough, almost feeling good about myself. And we ran out of coke. And so then we were both like, well, shit. So we just started asking around, where can we buy some? So we bought some from a shady looking guy. He just said, it's really good stuff. It's good stuff. He gave it to us and he disappeared. And then when we started snorting it, we realized it was not good stuff. In fact, it was not even stuff. It was my friend just said, this is doing nothing. It's not cocaine and I'm not doing it. And then I thought, well, it had numbed our gums when we bought it. So maybe it's really crappy cocaine. So maybe if I just snort the whole pile at once, I'll get high. So I did. And I didn't get high. It wasn't cocaine. But I did start to get something else, which was tunnel vision. So my outer periphery of my brain, of my vision, started getting all speckly the way it does if you're going to faint. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, this must be some cool side effect from cocaine that I haven't heard about. And I went in the bathroom, waited in line in the bathroom, and it got worse. And by the time I got to the stall, I couldn't read any of the graffiti, which I knew was not right. And it seemed to me it was very dark, as if somebody had been using a dimmer and was just turning it down more and more to the point where it's beyond candlelight, you know? And the speckles, my vision was tunnel vision. So I could only see directly in front. And I began to realize there was no air. And the reason it seemed to me there was no air was that the powder had been lidocaine, not cocaine, mm-hmm. which I learned many years later when I had friends in AA who are former drug dealers. And they said, we used to cut cocaine with lidocaine, but it sounds like you got sold pure lidocaine and it's poison. It shuts down your nervous system. So when I felt like there was no air, it's because my heart was beating slower and slower and slower. And I said to my date, there's no air down here. There's no air. I'm heaving my breath, but I'm not getting oxygen starvation is not fun. And so I started getting angry that nobody else knew what I was talking about. I've since heard that anger is another symptom of oxygen starvation. Mm-hmm. But the bartender gave me a glass of water and just, I said, it's not the issue, but I didn't say that, but that's what I was thinking. But I, just to please him, I took a sip. And so I don't know what I did with the glass, probably dropped it. But on the outside, what happened was I fal back. I had a grand mal seizure and a cardiac arrest. And then the bartender came out and did CPR. And I was completely unresponsive for 3 minutes. So that's what was happening for them. Mm-hmm. For me, I thought for a second I'd hit my chin on the bar somehow, like I'd slipped and hit my chin because something struck me under the chin. And I was flying up in the air like I'd been shot out of a cannon. And I really, the relief from where I had been and the situation I had been, I knew right away that was completely over. And I had a sense of Manhattan actually receding below me as I shot up into the sky. And my thought was, thank God I don't have to do all that silly stuff anymore. And by all that silly stuff, I meant what we're doing here. I meant I meant living in 3D and having a personality and all of that. I was like, phew, out of there. And I was just me. And I can't describe it except that I was all the part of my personality that is curious, all the part of my personality that is joyful and interested and wants to do stuff. Like, that's who I was. And all the rest, all the insecurity, the like, how am I doing? The critic, you know, that was left down there in the silliness. So I flew up in the air and I got a sense that I was a ballerina in real life. So I thought, I'll do a backbend and I'll do a dive. And that'll be cool. And it worked out perfectly. I did this overarching backbend and I was diving toward the water and it was the ocean below me and it went all the way to the horizon. And I also, like, how do you know these things? I just knew that it was an ocean completely free of pollution of any kind. I knew it was just pure and it was blue. It wasn't greenish or anything. And then I had a thought, like, if you're falling from this high, isn't it like concrete when you hit the water? But I didn't have the fear to go with that. I just thought, isn't that how it works? And I thought, well, we'll find out. And then I just dove into the water and then I was like, oh, okay, that's fine. Then I looked up and the surface was so far above me, but the bubbles were rising around me. It was very beautiful. And I had a longing to get to the surface and a little thought of how am I going to get there? It's so far up. But next thing I know, I'm surfacing. And there's no, instead of questioning, how did that happen? I would just think that's good. And then the one time I do remember questioning a tiny bit was that I saw the shore and I wanted to be there. And I just started swimming and then I was waiting out in the waves. And I thought, I'm like, that's cool. But I'm also like, and that's a little strange. That's all I thought. So I came out on the beach. It was not a tropical beach. It was kind of a rocky, barnacle-y beach. But I saw down to my left a house up on a mesa. It's very weather-worn. And I thought, that has to do with me. I want to go there. So next thing I know, I'm not at the door of the house. Unfortunately, I'm at the bottom of the mesa. And all the rocks are covered with this putrid green slime. It's just really grossed me out. And I thought, is this like rotten seaweed? What is this? But then I had that sense of, well, it's not stopping me. I'm getting there and I'm strong. So I can do this. So I started climbing. Next thing I know, I've reached the house, but I've somehow lost my body. So I'm only like an inch from the door sill. And instead of being confused, anything, I just thought, I'm still going to go in. That's all I cared about. And I thought, this is an inconvenience. I don't know what's going on. I don't know what happened to my body, but it's not going to stop me. So I crossed the door sill. As soon as I was in, I knew it was the house of my ancestors. I knew that all my ancestors had crossed that same threshold. And I could see the wood in front of me was all super worn, buried almost to a powder with the grooves of the wood that you can see. And I understood because we had all crossed. We had all walked, so many of us. And I began to feel my ancestors around me. And I could feel their joy that I was joining them. And I felt honor that I was with them. In my real life, I didn't even know who my cousins were. We were estranged from the rest of the family. And I had visits from grandmother, but I cared more really about the See's candy that she brought than about her, to be honest. And then the grandfather that I felt most excited, I had never met. And I was very excited to meet him. I had only seen his picture in my dad's closet, but he was the one who was most excited to get to greet me. And I felt all of them, but I couldn't see them. All I saw was that I'm in this room, and I know there's supposed to be a chair because there's a big picture window that looks out at the ocean. And my thought goes to, like, where's the chair? Why isn't it there? And then I thought, how am I going to admire the ocean? I want to see it. And as soon as I said, I want to see it, something pulled me by the sternum across the floor toward the window. Up until this point, all my movement had been from my will. I want to do this. This was something else. And I was very surprised, but I also felt very cool. Went over the floor, and then I went up towards the windowsill, and then I went over the windowsill, and then I was flying over the ocean. And I was surprised. I mean, I didn't see that one coming at all, and I was just overjoyed. And the sun was setting directly in front of me, and the sky was all these glorious colors. And the sun was making a path of gold that I was zooming over. And I'm talking about zooming, flying. And it felt so delicious and perfect and wonderful. And even without the body, I just had this sense of passing through space. I could feel it happening. And I thought, wait a second. I got this moment again of skepticism. And I said, people can't fly except in dreams. Is this real? And as soon as I asked, is this real? A voice answered me, very powerful voice, and it's telepathic. It's not in words, but you know better than with words because you don't have to translate it. And it said, more real than anything back there. And by back there, it meant back on Earth. And I was A, surprised that someone had heard my thought, and B, knew they were right. But I didn't really have a sense that they were flying with me. It's hard to say. I was not sure what to do with that. So the sun starts getting bigger and bigger. I begin to see like the corona, and I didn't feel heat. But I thought, am I going to vaporize? Like, aren't I going to burn up when I get too close? And even as I'm thinking this, it's just taking up my whole field of vision. And then I pass through a sort of filament, and I'm inside the sun. And inside the sun, there was only the light. And this is the common feature of NDEs. Many people will see things in the light. I only saw light. I could not see anything. And it was almost like if my mind were film, it was just completely exposed with this light. And it was love. And it felt warm and completely just fulfilling with this bliss. If you think of everything that we like or love or want as beings, it's all fulfilled. And I felt like finally, I felt like for so long I was fighting and trying and struggling and just longing for, I didn't even quite know what, but this is it. I am perfect. And then I got a sense that some being was holding me, was cradling me, and in its arms and pouring love into me, just adoring me. Sort of similar to that feeling I had when I lay on the grass as a 5-year-old, except a million times more. And it was just saying, you're so loved. And I was feeling love, and I just wanted to stay like that forever. And then this figure said, you can't stay. You're not done yet. And boom, black. It was just gone. The light was just gone. No transition at all. And I said, no. And I remember being furiously angry and wanting to throw a tantrum and wanting to kick I thought of it as the parent in the shins. And just show them that I had power too. And you weren't going to take this away from me. Then I felt myself dropping. I just felt a very gentle answer from the parent, which was, case closed, honey. Like, it's a done deal. And I felt myself dropping. I felt a tiny bit of fear, because dropping is never a good feeling. Mm-hmm. And then I began to see in the blackness these little chalk stick figures. And they were like little animated figures on a playground, and they were doing cartwheels, and they were going on swing sets, and they were going on teeter-totters, and they were saying these little rhymes. And they were nonsense rhymes, but they were giggling. They had these high little voices. And so, you know, they're like, how many hippos make a hopscotch? And I'm just thinking, well, this is nowhere good as the light, but I can just hang and watch this like it was Saturday morning cartoons, I guess forever. Like, that's what I felt like, you know, until I get to go back. And then one of them got closer, and his chalk circle face filled in solid like a dinner plate, and he's getting too close and blocking my view. And then I realized his rhyme is not very cute. It's how many fingers, what is your name? And then that's when I had this horrible realization that I was back in what I thought of as the meat puppet. And that came to me because it was as if I was loaded into a machine of some kind, and I didn't want to be there. And then I also understood with this huge sense of disappointment that he thought that we were separate, and he wanted me to do this thing I used to do. It felt like so long ago, where I'd push air out and make sounds out of it that were code for something. And I just felt like, no, I can't do this again. It's so primitive. And I like to compare it to being sentenced to kindergarten for decades and decades. But then I said two, and then I said Louisa, and then I was back. And I never went to a hospital because we were outside afterwards. We went outside and we were all waiting for the ambulance, unbeknownst to me. And a whole lot of people came out with us. All the gawkers came out with us. There was, when I came to, there was a whole circle of people around. And it had been 3 minutes that he'd been doing CPR, and I guess it had been quite, my friend said that I was gray, that I looked like a corpse, that I didn't look like myself at all. But when we were sitting outside, the bartender came over, told me you were gone for 3 minutes. And I was just embarrassed. This is the hardest part of the story to tell, that I was 22. And I just thought, oh my God, he had his mouth on my mouth. That's so embarrassing. Oh my God, he's got to be 30. He's kind of getting bald. That's so gross. Like, that's what I thought. And so I thought, I don't want him to think I like him or anything because of this. So I was just like, yeah, thanks a lot. And I just wanted him to go. And that's how I treated the man that saved my life and gave me these 41 years I've had since. And yeah, I don't know how to find him.
Wow.
But then I asked my friend, what are we doing? He said, we're waiting for the ambulance. And I'm like, okay, cool. And then I'm like, I got this bad feeling. I'm like, who's it for? And he's like, it's for you. You were dead. And then I just said, I don't want to go to the hospital. My parents find out. And he was a high school teacher at a private school. He didn't want to get messed up in it either. And so he just grabbed me, and we got in a cab and went home.
Mm-hmm. And then from there, I believe that you had sort of gaslit yourself and denied the experience you had because you were concerned that you might have to believe in a God and stop partying.
Get all churchy.
Get all churchy. That's exactly it. It was the next day, and I just sat and I thought, I know what happened was real, but if it was real, we didn't have a term for NDE back then. I had never heard of anything like this. But I did know that everybody maintained I had been dead. And I did know that I had had a vision way more vivid than here. And I could only connect that to religion. I didn't have any other kind of lexicon or whatever. So I just thought, okay, if I say this is real, then I have to go to church and I have to be a goody-goody and I have to just completely efface my personality and become some kind of Bible thumper. And I just can't do that. And so I thought, well, what if it was just some kind of hypoxic hallucination, not a dream? But what if when your brain shuts down, all that's left as the innermost spark is love? And so it seemed huge to me because everything else had faded away. And I was just like, you know what, I'm going with that. And then I don't have to change a thing. And so then I was thinking, but what about when he said, or it said, you can't say, what, do you remember that? And I'm like, yeah, but we're not going to think about that. And I was very good at not thinking about things because of my denial. When I think about the ND now, I went through all the elements. I went through air first, water next, then earth, then the wood was, and then fire. And so I was going through layers, you know, and I didn't at that point, whether because of the Good Samaritan, my angel saw a way to send me back. And he made the executive decision. A lot of NDEers get a choice. Do you want to go back? Not for me. And then the rage that I felt was re-entering the body. In my belief, wherever you want to put it, there is some barrier of anger and fear that separates us from each other and from the spirit world. And so to drop is a drop in vibration, because I had gone higher and higher into the sun, into love. Mm-hmm. And to come back to this level is a lower vibration. So I had to fall.
Yeah. You said machine. Felt like you were being put into like a mechanical kind of an apparatus.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I first, in the very first moments I was back, I was very much in my brain. I actually felt spatially that that's where I was. Mm. And so the mouth was way far down below and the body was so far away. It was kind of like California. You know, I knew it was there, but I didn't really know how to make it work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the body is pretty dense. And from what I've heard from other, well, I guess not directly from anyone I know who's passed, except for you now, but from other stories, that entering the body is very painful. It's very dense. And and most NDEers don't actually want to come back. And what I think is ironic is that you kind of threw a fit and a tantrum that you didn't want to come back. But, and then when you came back, you denied the other side.
Yeah.
Make up your mind.
Yeah. Yeah. But I have empathy for myself because I just didn't know anything about how to frame that experience. Mm-hmm. So it was just completely out of context with the rest of my life. And if somebody told you you have to change everything about yourself when you're 22, yeah, you're not going to do it.
I wanted to ask about the unconditional love that you feel on the other side of the veil. Mm-hmm. Because there's a book that I love called On Love and Loneliness by Jay Krishnamurti. And he talks about people being almost unable to experience unconditional love in this space.
Mm-hmm.
And when I hear about how on the other side of the veil, the love is so immense that you can love your partner back here and you can have a child and love them, but the love on the other side is like 100,000 times greater, that you almost don't even miss the people back left behind, if you will. Do you think that it is possible for humans on this 3D plane to experience and express unconditional love or come close?
We can, but you know those straws you use to stir your drink, like a cocktail thing, those little super skinny straws? That's what we're shooting love through or getting love through. And then God's like the fire hydrants busted open and it's just everywhere. And so it's unconditional, but the sheer power of the love on the other side is not something that we can experience or create. I mean, I love my son so much, but it's just this little tiny drop, you know, compared to an ocean.
Mm.
So,
So a lot of NDEers have a life review, maybe, perhaps. I'm not sure if you were experiencing any of that.
I didn't have any. Mm-hmm. And then you don't have to be. It's not that I wasn't old enough. Mm-hmm. It's just that we didn't get that far.
Yeah.
We didn't get that far.
Yeah, it sounds like it'd be a really humbling experience to have a life review and go over all of those moments in your life when you hurt someone or affected somebody in a negative way and to empathically feel what they felt.
Yeah, I've interviewed lots of people who have had that experience. And, you know, Roland, I can't think of his last name. He's in one video that I'm in. And he talked about that he could feel he had his friend hit a bee's nest and then shut the door on the friend so he couldn't get in. So he got stung all over. Mm. So he felt every bee sting that he had made his friend feel. But he also felt the bee's anger. You messed up our home.
Yeah.
And then he felt the kid's parents' confusion and anger as they came running to see what was going on. Like he lived everybody's experience of what he had caused with that trick.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
It's a lot to take in.
Yeah.
And from what I understand, that you'll be your worst critic and your biggest judger.
Yeah.
But spirit, and I don't know what you call it. Maybe you have a definition for God now, but that spirit isn't judging us the way that we're judging ourselves. We're just...
Yeah. And again, the people that I've interviewed had said they felt so much remorse. Mm-hmm. And what they felt from the spirit with them was empathy for them suffering that feeling of remorse. So it's like, we can see you did mess up. And now we see how much that's paining you. And it pains us to mm-hmm. see you pained that way.
Mm-hmm. So I assume you're no longer an atheist.
That's correct. I'm a woo-woo. I'm a woo-woo. That's so, what my book's about.
The next thing I wanted to ask you was, going into the woo-woo, since you mentioned it, you say that you came out of the closet three times. Could you go into those three times, and which one was the hardest and why?
Wow. I wasn't expecting this question. So the first one was coming out as queer. When my partner and I got together, we were super closeted baby dykes. We were felt like we were the only lesbians in the city of Seattle.
What year was that?
It's 1988.
Well, that makes sense then.
I think there were a couple more. But then we went to the off-ramp. And we were blown away. There were lesbians everywhere. And there were all kinds of lesbians, big lesbians, little lesbians, femme lesbians, butch lesbians. We were just like, ah! And then the thing that actually brought us out of the closet was that my partner took a class called Lesbianism at UW. And she came back. She said, the class is great. And she's like, I think the professor might be a lesbian. And then I think some of the other students are lesbian. Next thing you know, we're having all lesbian parties. And we're just, everybody in the class, we just became a group. And then that gave me the courage to tell my parents and my family. And my mom was furious. The first thing she said was she yelled at my dad, I told you so.
Oh, and the mom always knows, I'm telling you.
Yeah, and she had a lesbian experience in college and told herself that she was seduced and that it wasn't healthy and that it wasn't her idea. And blah, blah, blah. Anyway, it was only because all the men were at war, etc. But then, yeah, she was very disapproving of what she saw coming. And then my dad said he was very sad for me because life would be harder for me as a lesbian. Turns out I'm fluid. I've had times when I'm lesbian and I've had times when I'm straight. I don't say I'm bi because I'm not. It's sort of like a train. You move the track and it goes there. And then I've got to have another switch of the track. I'm not like on a pendulum or anything. But so coming out to her, and my sister was not, a lot of people were not happy with me saying how I was speaking that truth. So that was hard, and I did that. And then the next one was, I think, harder in some ways and easier in other ways because it was coming out as an alcoholic. First, you have to come out to yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's the same thing with being queer. You come out to yourself first. And as an alcoholic, it's there, you'll come out for a while and then you'll shut the denial again and then come out and then denial. I mean, denial is part of the disease. Yeah. And so I had to grind my life into the ground and have a divine experience from my angel before I realized I really could not do this thing. But then, I went to AA and then you have a very strong community behind you. So when I told my parents I was alcoholic, the most thing was that it was very embarrassing because everybody knew my father was. And so if I say I am, it implies he is. And everyone was super uncomfortable with that. So Nobody in my family has ever taken any kind of interest in my recovery. Brought my sister to one AA meeting. She hated it. And that's the only thing I tried to do. And then the third is coming out as a woo-woo, which is the hardest. Because, while my family wasn't happy with me being queer and my circle of friends wasn't happy with me being an alcoholic, the whole world is not happy with me being a woo-woo. And the whole world's scientific or what, we call consensual reality. The consensual reality, we have all consented to this agreement that the world is material. And when you say, no, that's only a small part of the world, that's only a small part of experience, it's very uncomfortable for people and they just change the subject.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So when was that moment, what happened to cause you to accept or actually validate your near-death experience? Did you have a paranormal encounter?
Or many paranormal encounters. So I'll just kind of tick them off as they happened. And if you want me to expand on one, I can. The first one was 5 years later, saw a ghost. The next one was 10 years later, knew that my unborn nephew was going to die. I didn't know specifically how he was going to die, but I knew my brother's grief at his death would be overwhelming. Then I was spoken to by my angel twice about my drinking. Then I'm trying to think, I went to Greece after I got sobered, 100 days sober, and there were so many paranormal experiences, so many miracles there. And then I came back, and when my sister died, I had paranormal experiences around after she died, having contact with her. And they just kept coming until it was really, voices in the car telling me not to go at a stoplight. A lot of things happening. But then there was one where I had a dream that came true. And it's not a very dramatic one to other people. What I think I'd like to talk about for you is the time that my angel interceded about my alcoholism.
Yeah, that would be great. And does this angel have a name?
He does now. He didn't then. He didn't even have a gender. He's the same guy who said more real than anything back there. He's the same guy who was holding me in the sun. Mm-hmm. And when you ask me about my God, I do know of a God, but I give it a small letter G just to distinguish it from what other people are talking about in religion. And God does not care if it's a small G or a big G. Yeah.
He's the OG.
That's right. So I just call God God, but my intermediary is Ignacio, my angel. So I always feel I can see, me, Ignacio, God. That God, Ignacio is an expression of God, and so am I. But there's more God in Ignacio than there is in me, I think. I'm not sure on that one. I'll get back to you after I'm dead.
Again, yeah.
But so Ignacio, I was at my near my bottom drinking. So this would be 1994 in the winter, and I was going to parties. My partner had left me because I'd become obsessed with a boy at the espresso shop where I worked. And I went to a party. It was a kegger. I drank till I was falling down again and again, drunk. I was 34 and going to keggers with youngsters. And so two of my friends took me to somebody's house. One of them drove my car. One of them drove another car. They took me to this house. They put me in. They said, "You sleep, don't drive." And then they left. And they left my keys on the table. So when I was sure they were gone, I got up, staggered out there, got the keys. I have a very clear memory of trying to find the ignition and it just not being there. It just not, just wasn't going to happen.
The ignition.
Exactly. And I tried and tried and tried and tried and tried and finally got the ignition. And then I took off for where I lived, like, I don't know, 30 miles away. And a lot of it was these winding dark roads and I was going 80 miles an hour. And I was suicidal. So I was selfish to an extreme and suicidal. So I just kind of thought, I hope that I crash the car into a tree or something and die. That would be nice. Or even if I just get kind of vegetative, then at least no one will expect me to do anything anymore because I just can't. And I didn't really think about the other people I could kill. So I was going along and I came to overpass where the road went over a railroad track, and the reflective signs, I just saw a sea of those striped reflective signs. I thought, I don't even care. And so I just shot through at 80 miles an hour and it came out on the other side and I was like, woohoo! And I got to my log cabin, got out of the car, and I couldn't stand. So I was just using the door to hold myself up. And it was a starry night. I looked up at the stars and I thought, man, I drive so good when I'm shit-faced. Like, that was my thought. And then my angel, he shot something through me. And it felt to me at the time as if it came from the stars, threw me into the ground like lightning. That's what it felt like. But it was these thoughts. And so the first one was, this is the last time I can help you. And the second one has so many connotations we can talk about. If it's like, you do know right from wrong. That's what he said. And he let me know it had been he that got me across that bridge. And my memory of the bridge is perfect. Even, I mean, the key thing, and then the bridge is perfect, and then the standing there, and then I'm in blackout for the rest of it. Mm. And so, like, the moment he got me across the bridge is crystal clear, because spiritual memories, whenever he's with me, it forms a memory that doesn't fade, just as my near-death experience has not faded. And the other times that he's been with me have not faded. But I then woke up in the morning and I'd made a horrible mess with the oatmeal and left the milk out and just things that drunk people do. Mm-hmm. But I don't know what that thing was, but I knew it had something to do with that thing that happened back in 1982. But I still wanted to be atheist. I was reading all this Bukowski. I was full of all of this, like, life sucks and then you die stuff, you know, yeah. And all you should do is get laid. Like, that just was kind of where I was at. And so, but then after I didn't get sober then, it took me another month before I finally went to AA. And when I first went into my first meeting, I didn't mean to stay. I didn't know they could all tell that I was new, but I felt this new weird thing in the room, and it was love. Mm-hmm. And I didn't really know what it was, but I know it felt good in there. And so I kept going back. So, but the implication that when he said, this is the last time I can help you, for me, this underscores free will, because I had the choice to smash my brains, throw my life away, do these things if I wanted to. he was like a parent that, you know, keeps the toddler from falling, but at a certain point you've got to walk toddler. Mm-hmm. And so he's letting go. And that's sort of like Al-Anon. It's like people who have so much trouble not giving money to the addict, not, you know, giving them a place to live, not helping the addict. They've got to walk on their own. And at a certain point, you've got to let go. It's a loving thing to do. Mm. And then the other is fascinating. You do know right from wrong. And it implies that poisoning your body, poisoning your brain, endangering other people, living for just to get laid, whatever you want to say. Not that I was very much. it's not what is right. You know, we're given these gorgeous gifts of these bodies and minds, and we're here to do something. We don't get to quite know what. So many NDEers say, on the other side, I knew exactly what the purpose of my life was, but as soon as I was back in the body, I couldn't think of it. Mm-hmm. And right and wrong is not, he's not talking about the Bible. He's not talking about anybody's agenda. What he's talking about is positive growth is right, and just rampant pointless destruction is not. Mm-hmm. And that's what he was telling me. You know the difference. Mm-hmm. And that comes back to me very often, because the more I have tried, and in AA we often say, do the next right thing.
Mm. I like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just do the next right thing. And incrementally, by just doing the next right thing, I've transformed completely my life and who I am to a place of joy. You know, from that place where I just wanted to be in a hospital as a vegetative whatever, to a place where I adore my life.
So you've come to adore your life.
Mm-hmm.
But if you could, do you ever crave to be on the other side again, despite loving what you have here?
No. My angel has made it clear to me, and I was just talking with a friend about this today. So she's also an NDEer. She probably wouldn't mind if I said Brooke Grove, and she's a therapist as well. And when we were talking about how sometimes we'll be praying to our guides, she says guide, I say angel, and we'll be like, I'm having so much static and pain and anxiety right now about, for me, my mom died, we got to sell her house, I'm the only person here in Seattle, I'm saddled with so much stuff to take care of and to get rid of. And I have to go through belongings and throw away things that are precious. And it's super painful. And I'll get home and I'm so nervous. I hit my head twice recently, just out of like when you get to that point of being frazzled. And I'll meditate and I'll say, I understand none of this is really important or in my power. And I'll say, like, can't you just take away this anxiety and this scaredness and this, and what he always answers is be human. And my feeling is that we don't have on the other side these thicker, heavier, painful emotions.
Mm-hmm.
There is a lightness to the other side where you cannot feel the sadness of classical music, or, you know, I don't mean the sadness, but I just mean there are certain types of emotion that are gooey and thick, and we feel them here, mm-hmm. and they don't. On the other side, my angel laughs a lot, you know, and he's always like seeing humor. Sometimes I can sense he's like rolling his eyes when I say something silly, and he's got tons of love. But when he tells me be human, I get a sense that he misses.
Interesting.
These feelings.
Mm. I often wondered that.
Yeah.
Because I was thinking today when I was coming to our office to interview you, and I was setting up, and I was like, I like it here. I literally said that out loud. I like it here. And I'm going to miss playing this character, this short little spunky doctor chick. Like, she was pretty cool.
Yeah.
Because I know, at least for me, I feel that I believe in reincarnation. Mm-hmm. And I'll come back. And there's a question I want to ask you about them. That I'll play someone else.
Yes.
You know, hopefully someone with, you know, who's a little taller. But it's like, there are things here that we experience that they don't. And mm-hmm. I'm not sure if I was on the other side, if I'd miss it. But I certainly appreciate it mm-hmm. now, here. Mm-hmm. Here and now, and being human.
And there have to be, like, I always feel that we are, our job here is to choose love again and again and again. And so there's a course of hurdles. It's not mm-hmm. just like, ding, ding, you win the car, you got that's love. Right. No, it's like, choose it again. Oh, here's a new challenge. Choose it again.
Initiations.
Yeah.
Yeah. You've talked before in some other interviews, I've heard of the wake, the wake that we leave is a big part of it. I really mm-hmm. liked your words around that.
Yeah, that behind you should mm-hmm. leave. It's actually not me. That's another NDEer's mm-hmm. experience. But mm-hmm. she was told, Barbara Ireland was told, that what matters was not her music itself or her writing itself, but the wake she leaves behind her mm-hmm. as a human mm-hmm. is every person that interacts with her a little happier. They feel a little more hopeful about life, or do they feel discouraged?
And you told a story about kind of a rough looking character at an intersection, right? That you said that you got it.
Yeah. We both jumped out of the car. I didn't know I ever told that story.
I loved it. Will you tell it to us?
Yeah. Well, it's just what life is about. It just said I was somewhere at a stoplight. I realized I needed something from the trunk of the car and I jumped out and the guy next to me jumped out of his car. I could hear that he was playing loud rap music and he was kind of scrappy looking African-American guy and just different from me. But he went and he opened his trunk. And so I looked across to him and I just thought, this is really weird. And so I said, this is the intersection where the cool people get out of their cars. And he said, word. And then we drove and got in our cars. But the spark that passed between us at that second made my angel happy. I know when he's like, good job. And another time I just remember being downtown and there being kind of a crowd. And I just asked this guy, what's everybody looking at? And he said, there's an owl up in that tree. And I looked too and I saw the owl and I said, what is it about owls that makes everybody like get filled with wonder? And he goes, I don't know, but it does. And so, and it was just another, I love those little conversations. And I always feel like that's my job. I'm doing my job mm-hmm. when I make someone smile or feel seen or somehow feel that humanity is good.
Mm-hmm. And Louisa, I'm wondering too about these moments of that where medical intuition arose. Like there was a story about you were on a hike and your knee was really feeling injured mm-hmm. and you had an interaction with a tree. And then there was all this insight on step by step, mm-hmm. how to care for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, you guys have watched the interviews.
Yeah. Yeah,
we studied you, my dear.
We stopped you.
Well, when I think back about that time, I have to say that I was in a state of joy. And, you know, Brooke was asking me today, how do you hike alone? You know, and you just have to feel that there is goodness everywhere. I don't get the same feeling hiking in a place where a lot of people go and where the forests are relatively new. So when the forests are planted by us and they're all the same kind of tree, it's not the same kind of neighborhood. When you're in an old forest, they've grown into these symbiotic relationships of helping each other and knowing the trees know each other and everything is in harmony and they are generating goodness and you can just feel it. And I feel protected by that. Mm. So on this particular day, I was, well, the first thing was, this is kind of a side thing. I don't know. You can edit it out if you don't want it, but my angel can see ahead. There's a lot of bifurcations in the choices I make of what my future will be. And you can picture a Plinko game where it's going to go this way or that way, this way or that way. And he can see when there's a high likelihood that I will die. And for some reason, that happens quite often to me. Mm. Uh-huh. But anyway, so I was hiking down this very, very steep cirque. And what he yelled at me was not be careful. It was, this is where you fall. That's what he said. Mm. And so I thought, okay, I thought back to him, I'll be careful. And then he doesn't swear, but it's the same energy as when you swear, right? And he goes, listen, I mean it. This is where you fall and it's bad. And so I said, well, what do you want me to do? And so I had just climbed over this huge ridge. And so I really wanted to go fast, but I just took little baby steps and I'm checking with him. Is this slow enough for you? And he's like, yes, that's good. That's good. So I went really slow. And then I came to a big piece of granite and I down climbed it and I took a picture with my phone, put the phone back in the sandwich bag and something went in my knee and it just hurt really, really bad. And I realized if I had been walking full speed and that had happened, I would have tumbled. And this is a place where you probably couldn't stop. You know, when you can mm-hmm. see the zigzagging switchbacks below yeah. you. And so then I thought, okay, well, that was what that was about. But when I got to camp, it hurt a little bit more. And it hurt a couple times, just a little bit. But I thought, okay, I'm asleep. I'll feel better. And I like to describe the British boys who came because it just shows the state I'm at. Because when I'm not in a high vibration and I've got a campground all to myself and other people come, I'm like, you bastards. Now you're going to like talk and wreck my solitary spot. Whereas I felt like, oh, here's some other kids. How fun, you know? And then to hear their story that, you know, one had been on the PCT and he sent the pictures home that were so beautiful that his British brother flew out and now they were hiking together. And one of them had a bad ankle and they weren't sure they were going to make it. And anyway, we traded food and I just felt full of love for them. So much love. And I prayed at that night, you know, thank you for all the blessings in my life. And when I got up in the morning and started hiking, I was at such a high vibration. That's what I can say now. I wasn't thinking that at the time, but I just loved the plants. I loved the flowers. I loved the little bugs. I just loved everything. And then my knee went again and it was worse. And I could not take a step. I was stuck on this switchback near Mica Lake in the Glacier Peak Wilderness. Nobody anywhere around because Ed and Nick had long since taken off. And so I looked up the mountain. I looked down the mountain. I thought about using my inReach. And this is when I made the choice. I had an inReach. I knew the logical thing to do was to use the inReach. But I just felt like it was some stupid popular culture thing that I wasn't going to do. And I thought, I've heard so many people tell me about miracles. Why don't I get a miracle? That's what I thought. And then I thought, I don't get a miracle because I just don't deserve it. And I kind of got a little bit of that like self-loathing thing. And I thought, I just wish there was somebody here who knew me and loved me. And that's when I looked up and I saw the big tree. And it was ahead of me. And my first thought is, what is a big tree like that doing here? Like 7,000, 6,000 feet? What are we at here? It shouldn't be that big. And then I thought, man, that tree is old. And I thought, it's a matriarch. And I knew she had love. So I just said, you are my person. And I went and I hugged her. And I put my forehead on her. And I said, can you ask God, basically, to send me a miracle to help me? And she answered. The first thing I said is, are you there? And she said, I am. That's what she said, I am. And I felt it in my forehead. I felt this other presence. And so then I was excited. And I was like, can you ask God to help me? And she sent a message. And she said, each life must ask directly. And I took it in and I recognized, like, yeah, I see that's true. And I said, but I'm shy and I don't feel like God's going to do anything. So could you please? And then she's just going, each life must ask directly. And it's getting fainter. And she's just like, that's all you're getting from me. Mm. And so I kissed her. And I was weeping. My heart was just really, really out there. And I took another step. I thought maybe she fixed me. And then it went again. My knee went again. And so then I just said, God, I know I'm here because of vainglory. That's the word that came out, meaning it's my hubris that I can be superwoman here. But you also know I love this with a genuine love. Can you give me some guidance? And as soon as I said the word guidance, I was downloading tons. I could just feel the download of knowledge. And it's kind of like it needs to break up into pieces. But the first thing was, the problem is not your knee. It's that you've strained your inside of your leg. And it's pulling your knee out of alignment, so it's hitting a nerve. And I was like, don't be silly. Like, it's always my first thought, you know. There's nothing wrong with my inner thigh. And so he's like, put it up on a rock and stretch it. And I couldn't even get it up on a rock because it was so tight. And so then I'm thinking, okay, maybe he's right. Maybe there's something to this inner thigh pulled out of alignment thing. So he says, stretch it like every 100 feet, put it up and stretch it again. So I'm doing that and then I can walk. And then he says, take your trekking pole, and he can pull stuff from my memory. And he shows me with a physical therapist when the therapist had me roll a towel and put my knee patella on it. And he says, do that with your trekking pole, pull it. And he said, and then put the leg up and stretch it. Do both of those things. So
I love this.
I know. So then I love it. I'm doing both of those things. And I'm thinking, okay, this is the end of the messages because it seems to be kind of working. Like I'm able to walk some now. And then he says, get out that little piece of Velcro that you don't know what the heck it's doing in your pack. And I had a clear memory of going through things and you want to be light. You don't want to carry anything you're not going to use. And I thought I had taken this little piece of Velcro and put it on the don't bring pile. But then I would find it in my stuff and I'd be like, why do I have this? And he goes, this is why. You're gonna fasten it just under your patella. And I'm like, how tight is it supposed to do something? And then he gave me another memory from the physical therapist, where the physical therapist is kind of talking to me at this point. He wasn't really doing much, but he was just going, nobody knows why kinesthetic tape works. We have all these different theories, but really we don't know. One of them is that it just tells the brain where to send healing. And he said, that's what we're doing with this little Velcro thing, except it will tell me where to send healing.
Ooh,
I know. And then that's when he said, I will heal you. You will finish. And he had so much joy in saying, in giving me this gift. And I said back, I said, I thought we were just trying to get me to the next side trail so I could get off, so I could get help. And he's like, no. You're going another 60 miles and you're going to finish. And my knee never hurt me again.
It's incredible.
I know. And he faded out. Once I got into, I remember getting to my next camp and after dark, this kid arrived. He was 18 and he came up to my tent and he said, can I borrow your flashlight? That's kind of a big deal. So I'm like, you know what? No, you're lighter. You're lighter. That's what it was, which is even a bigger deal. But I had an extra. I think I had two extras. So I just gave him one. And then I went over and sat with him. And he was just a kid, my son's age. We're sitting in the dark on a tree root. And he starts telling me about how he fucked up his ankle running, doing something, you know. And I thought, yeah, I said, yeah, I fucked up my knee too. And then I'm like, I can tell him. And then I'm like, but no. It's still happening. I can't make it a story when I'm in the middle of it. It's too sacred.
Uh-huh.
And so I didn't tell him.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it sounds like there's some little benefits of these NDE experiences. Like, do you know if it's possible for people who have either not died and come back or have not been born with extrasensory abilities, is there a way to connect with these abilities? Mm-hmm. And because I feel that we all have we have it in us, the accessibility mm-hmm. to it, but I'm not sure how we can, I guess, achieve those.
Mm-hmm.
But I just, I think it's just incredible that so many of these NDEers have these extra sensory capabilities. They are really intriguing to me.
Right. Well, I spoke before about us being surrounded by anger and fear in some way to block out the energy. Because if we could, well, I talk about this in the book, but if we were distracted by spirit things, we'd get eaten by the tiger. We have to be engaged in the physical world if we're going to stay in the physical body. So it has evolutionary reasons for us not to be distracted.
Right.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if God does want us to choose love again and again and again, and we can see the spirit and the love and everything, we'll be like, it's like getting the answer key. Like, we're just like, I got it. Love's the answer. I'm not going to be greedy anymore. You know what I mean? We would just have that answer. And then I would say that when we have an NDE, we bust through that and we damage it. And Bruce Grayson thinks we damage something in the brain that is some kind of screen. But I think it's a physical aura thing that we actually pass out of. Think of it like if I had a bubble around me and I shot through it and then I came back through it, it's still got a tear.
There's a tear.
Yeah. And that's how he's able to reach
me. Tearing the fabric.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Huh? And I even find that he mostly talks to me from the left. Mm-hmm. I feel like my tear is kind of somewhere here. There's a picture of him as an orb and he's to the left. But what I know is I also accidentally read minds, and it happens when I'm in a state of love. Like that same thing I was talking about on the mountain where I loved everything. There have been times when I'm just with friends and I feel loving, and what's happening, I don't realize it, is my vibration is mm-hmm. higher. So we were like one time all cooking something to bring to a homeless camp, and we just had to hang out and wait while the sauce, what do you call that? Down,
yes, reduces.
You reduced, yeah. And so we were playing guessing games, and I kept guessing the guy on my left. I kept knowing what his word was before he said anything, and I realized we're probably somehow vibrationally in tune. But we were both in a high state of lovingness, both from what we were doing and just from the safe feeling. But I would say that if you can bring up your vibration through love, you thin your membrane. Mm. And this does two things. One, if your membrane is too thick, if you're filled with anger, you are starving in there, right? Mm. And basically you're getting no spirit energy from anybody. And so you're just starving yourself. And then when you die, some people get stuck. They can't pass through it. Mm. So what that turns into is hell. Hell is being not in your body, but not rejoining spirit. Mm.
The in-between.
The in-between. Mm-hmm. And the ghosts that I've seen, they are also not able or willing to go to the light. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know which. But if the more you raise your vibration, the more you love, the more you take joy. And, you know, Tara Brach calls it, you're my friend, right? Mm-hmm. So you're my friend, Jeanette, and you're my friend, Janelle. But so is the tree that grew this table here in front of us, you know, and the whatever is around us comes from something natural. And I would even say you know, that this is, maybe there's some hubris and maybe this will be laughable tomorrow, but I'm 63 and a half and I'm planning to climb Mount Baker this summer with my nephews. And I feel a lot of the reason that I am so healthy is that I live in love. And that means that, yeah, I've got a lot of anxiety about this house that I've got to sell and clear out and everything. But I really love my recycling basket. I really love the moss on my steps. I love just that I wake up in the morning and, you know, can do yoga. Like, it's not like this is worthy of love. It's just that my attitude towards everything is, you're my friend. And I feel like at the cellular level, that makes me thrive. Mm-hmm. So it's not only that I can read minds or talk to angels, but it's also that my cells get fed from being in this higher vibration.
Yeah, that's the medicine is in the mm-hmm. the vibe, as you're saying, in the yeah. frequency.
Yeah.
And uh-huh. Also gratitude. Mm-hmm. Like you're saying, I even love my recycle bin. It's like, if you love right. your recycle bin,
and
I
feel like you guys
myself.
Live this way too.
Yeah.
Right? And I hope, and Brooke hopes, and my NDE friends, we hope that the world is waking up to this, that the ultimate medicine is love and connection. Mm-hmm. And that's how AA heals people and transforms their lives, is to teach them love and service. Mm-hmm. And that service to others feeds you. Mm-hmm. It's in religion, but somehow in religion, it has become like a canned pea is to a pea. It's just not the same yeah. thing, yeah. right? And a real pea that you've just picked off the vine, it's like, no, here, now. Really, like mm-hmm. love people. Mm-hmm. Like really, like love your recycling bin. And just love being alive. And I just realized I told this girl that I would drive her to her AA meeting, and I feel really bad right now. I don't know her name. I mean, I just realized tonight that I'm supposed to be doing that. So I'll text her afterwards and I'll say, I'm so sorry I was doing this podcast. But my point is that that's what AA lets me do, is connect to people I don't know. And she had like 26 days. I've got 29 years. And I don't go to AA meetings for me anymore. Yeah. I do in that I go to help, right? But I went from being this miserable, self-pitying, self-centered, miserable specimen to someone filled with joy because of things other people took time to help me. And my angel is kind of not Pharisee, but anyway.
Oh, and then there's just the angel. Yeah. You know.
Yeah, okay. But anyway, I need to give back. Also, my angel, I mean, I my angel has, there have been times when I've seen someone who's a hot mess and I've said, no, I am not going to sponsor her. No, no mm-hmm. way. Not inviting that chaos into my life. Mm-hmm. And he has said to me, you know, how is she any crazier than you were? And then I'm going, mm-hmm. oh, yeah, I was crazy, wasn't I?
I'm curious, Louisa. You're clear that that your angel has a masculine energy. Mm-hmm. And when was that clear to you? And what were the qualities that let you understand that?
So I really wanted him to be a goddess. And when I first got sober, I would only pray to goddess. And I just felt like as a queer feminist, I wanted a goddess. It's like, mm-hmm. so I thought it's going to be a goddess. And as he's become more clear to me, as I've heard him better, he's masculine. And I just didn't really want it, but he is. Mm-hmm. And so I did have one friend who saw him as an aura and said he's really, really powerful and he travels to your left. And I said, did you get a sense if he was masculine or feminine? She's like, no, he's just power. I mean, it's just powerful. She didn't have a... But then I was trying to find out about past life regression. And I was calling and this medium in California said, no, no, I don't do progressions over Zoom. No, I don't. Who is with you? Oh my God, he's so old. He's so... And then she said, he's so masculine. And see, I don't quite get that because when I did do the past life regression, like you said, my past life immediately before this was as a overweight cigar smoking businessman in New York City, wheeling and dealing with rights to Warner Brothers stuff, you know? And that was what I considered the shizzle was like, I'm going to close the deal. And he and I got in kind of a fight during my regression because I was having to say what he wanted to say. And I was like rolling my eyes and like, God, this guy is a materialistic, like egotistic. And I just, it was a conflict. And he was also pulling my voice down. He wanted me to talk like this. And I didn't want to talk like that. So I was going back and forth. But he said, how is what I, he said, you choose your mountain. You like the mountains. Mine was the deal. And he said, what matters is how you apply yourself to it. So in other words, I was a man many times in past life. So I don't know what it is about Ignacio, except that he somehow become who he is. And it's masculine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Some of the properties that I feel with the divine masculine is purifying and protective. Is a force of purification mm-hmm. and protection.
He does think I'm adorable. He calls me little one, but I've interviewed other NDEers. Their angels call them little one too. So it's not just me.
That's really sweet though.
Yeah, no. And it reinforces this toddler thing. Mm-hmm. Many of us feel that we are loved as a toddler is loved. Mm-hmm. It's that same kind of like, don't really know what's going on, but they mean well, and they got a lot to learn, you know?
Sort of like this naive, innocent time of life. And sometimes I think that maybe that toddler role needs to be replayed because a lot of people aren't held by their parents, loved unconditionally. And I think most injuries happen when we're that age.
Yeah, and we're all still carrying the toddler inside us. And when you can see that in other people, when you can, you know, it's so easy to love a toddler. So an exercise I often do is if I'm in the airport or something like that, just imagine everybody's a toddler. Just see their toddler self, right?
You toddler, people watching toddler eyes. That's really sweet.
It's actually like a new like verb.
Yeah, no, I just transform everybody at the bus stop to a toddler. You just let yourself see them that way, and it's much easier to love them.
Yeah. I can relate to that because I'll do something similar to that where I am imagining that they're a child, but I'm imagining I'm their mother and looking at them and this love that I have for them. I try not to see my patients as adults because I find so many... I guess physical injuries or maladies are connected to the emotional body and to that child trauma or even just adult relationships. But anyway, so if I can look at them as if they were my toddler, it changes. It changes how I work with them.
And that's your role because you're in the role of a healer. And when I'm in the airport, though, I'm a toddler too. We're all toddlers, you know, because then it just blows my mind to realize that every single one was adorable.
Yeah.
There was a, you can take any person and know that factually, if you could have seen them, you would have just wanted to pick him up and cover him with kisses.
Yeah.
And now you're like, you weirdo, stay away from me. You know, and it's right. just very yeah. sad yeah. that so we can't love each other with the things that we grow to become.
Yeah. Yeah, it's even like somebody's throwing a fit or angry. I've done some training around nonviolent communication, and I think that that's, you know, just really acknowledging the deep needs that everybody has. And if they're unmet, then there's going to be a storm. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I like that idea of just really seeing that younger self in people. And there's forgiveness and calmness that mm-hmm. can be their a rational response mm-hmm. Rather than returning the ire and the anger.
Yeah, toddlers throw fits and that's you don't, right. you like, know, yeah, you don't.
That's what you do.
Yeah. You just let
there you go.
Throw it.
Nice. So now that you're back and you've been back, mm-hmm. do you feel that you are in purpose that... And I don't want to speak for you, but I know you alluded to it, that being here in, of service mm-hmm. Is something that you do day to day that fills
you. No, I don't want to sound like as I've gotten more and more comfortable with my AA home group, where we all have 20-some years, mm-hmm. that's where I go most often. I went to a different one. For my actual 29th birthday, and that's when I got a nudge from Ignacio, because there were, at this meeting, 15 people with less than 30 days, and the energy in that room was dark. Mm-hmm. I was there with my friend, who incidentally just recovered from leukemia and lymphoma. He had both. He had a lot of contact with fire foam when he was young and in the Navy. He said they used to make a beard with it, like a Santa beard. You know, they just didn't know it was highly carcinogenic. But he's well now, and he's putting on weight again. So he came with me. We were sitting in this AA meeting, and we were laughing and joking. And I kind of looked around and realized, wow, the energy is heavy and dark in here. And then when they all said 15 days, 7 days, 1 day, I realized there's a lot of people in here who are going to die. And there's a lot of people in here who are completely lost. So I gave my number to this one girl, but I need to go back. And just maybe the two women in there can help, but I can also just speak. I mean, when I spoke, I raised the energy. I definitely did. That was my goal, is to raise the energy. Mm-hmm. But there's, for lack of a better word, so much dark coolness in this room of mostly young people not knowing, as I didn't know, how to embrace spirit without being a goody-goody. They don't know how to let go of being cool. You know, and so they're just like, how do I stop the drugs and alcohol, but still feel like I'm cool and badass? And like, humility is a hard sell. Yeah. But it's the most freeing thing there is, right? Mm-hmm. And until you can just sort of let go, laugh at yourself, see yourself as a toddler, you know, then you're going to be trying to prove something, and you can't really just be free or sincere mm-hmm. in that. Mm-hmm. So I feel for them, and I know how it feels, because I was there for a long time myself.
Mm-hmm. What is the one thing that you, if you could tell your younger self, circa 22, one thing that you've learned?
I often say that I had to live through each thing. There is no shortcut. There is no shortcut. However, I just got a text today from someone who said, so-and-so told me that you had an NDE. I had one in April. So less than a year ago, and they're already reaching out to somebody. And I have a lot to say to that person. Mm-hmm. I can't say anything to my younger self because it just wasn't known then, you know? You know, I can't think of anything that could have taught me except the road that I walked. But I know that I can help other people. I know shortcuts through the bays now, and I can help this person. I can bring them to Ions. I can introduce them to, you know, the different YouTube channels and just open the world of NDEers for them. And, you know, what Kim Sharp has done, who started the Seattle Ions here, I just saw her this morning. She just listens, you know, and says, "You're not crazy." And that's what I can do for this person.
Mm. Well, that's super fascinating and really beautiful. I know that you have a few books.
Mm-hmm.
And we can go ahead and make sure to add those to our show notes so that people can reference them. Is there anything that you're doing these days? Maybe, like you were talking about YouTube channels, do you do any classes or do you have any groups?
No. I want to caution people that the addiction memoir is really for people with addiction of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a long, long book and it tells my whole story. I often say it's like going to a speaker's meeting where the speaker talks for 10 hours. Okay. If you're into that, that's the addiction memoir. And then the other one, the near-death experience one, repeatedly cuts to the chase, cut to the chase, cut to the chase. So that's the difference. I have my blog that I write for alcoholics, and it's called A Spiritual Evolution, all one word, .net. And I am thinking of adding videos there. I am thinking of just sitting down and talking to the camera about spiritual stuff.
The woo-woo.
Yeah, about woo-woo, yeah. And I'm just trying to address, so many people come into AA and they think they're going to have to swallow religion. They think it has something to do with religion, and that will kill them because they will say, "I can't."
Mm-hmm.
And just as I said, "I can't," and then they will die. Mm-hmm. You know, my boyfriend that I love very much died in July alone in his beautiful house at 60 years old on his 60th birthday from a gastric hemorrhage brought about by drinking. And he couldn't get the God thing. That was the last text he sent to me. The last text he sent. Mm-hmm. He says, I can't find a higher power or a sufficient substitute. And that's literally the last text.
Wow.
So
he's on his way.
I talked to him.
Good. Yeah. He's on his way to find.
Yeah, no, he was very, very shocked to see his dead body. He was all freaked out by that and came to me and he was like, I survived. I'm like, I know he did. And he was also very relieved to someone could hear him. And he made it right with me because we had some problems. And he also came in dreams and made things right. But in any case, getting back to that, I want to help people find a higher power that they can be comfortable with.
Awesome. That's really, really a beautiful mission because people have really made it weird.
Yeah.
And the interface, the direct interface with God is really something so different.
It is.
It's a union that is beyond any of the silliness that people have built around it.
And isn't it always like the most precious thing? People try to put it in a box. And that's what they did with the Bible or the Quran. Or the, you know, you can't put it in between two covers, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, they'd patent water if they could, but they can't. And God should be the same way. It should be as free-flowing.
Mm-hmm. I love that. Yeah, the dogma, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you so, so much.
Thank you, Lily.
Thank
for
you for having
today.
Me. It's been really fun talking to you guys.
We love this conversation and this topic because we think that medicine is all around us.
Mm-hmm.
And that means literally all around us and on the other side and in all directions.
Yes,
so.
Within and without.
All right.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
hope this conversation has empowered you. Remember, you are unique and you are a miracle. Your body doesn't make mistakes. It responds perfectly to an imperfect environment. Until next time, go get that life.